once a month for maybe a handful of months now, breaking form slightly by doing a proverb. But because this chapter is kind of works as a whole chapter, I can treat it kind of like a psalm. And so that's why I wanted to cover it this way. Proverbs 30 contains really, really interesting topics and messages. I put one of them up here that I think most of us probably have seen or been familiar with it at one point in time or another. There's three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on the rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. And I've seen this. It's beautiful text. It's beautiful scripture, beautiful poetry. And there's probably a lot that we could think about just within the lines that we're given. But I think a lot of times when we're reading Proverbs, our minds go to doing just that, that we just look at it as this one little snippet, and then the next phrase you see is going to be about something different, and then you're going to go to another phrase about something else totally different. Proverbs 30, though, I think needs to be read as an interconnected whole. Case in point, the very next line after that sounds different, but it ends up being talking about the same thing. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, "I've done no wrong." So there's kind of a interstitched commentary that as you look at that other line, the way of an adulterous woman, you can go back and forth. It's not a part of the three or four grouping, but the use of the way of matches it to those other ones. And so as we go back and forth and meditate on those, there's wisdom to be gained. This is also a proverb that has another famous phrasing or sentencing about commitment. Two things I have asked of you, that is asked of God, I think. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion. That I not be full and deny you and say, "Who is the Lord?" Or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. And so here we see this request for contentment. One of those lines, feed me with the food that is my portion. Well, look back at that last line we showed. What does the adulteress do? Metaphorically, she wipes her mouth and says, "I've done no wrong." She eats meal after meal after meal of her sin. And so maybe there's more about the contentment that the writer of this proverb is seeking than just being full of food and what that means. So that's the approach we're going to take to this proverb tonight. It may be a little bit less emotional than the typical psalm, given that we're in Proverbs. But I also think in some ways it's almost a little bit more fun. You can read in the beginning of Proverbs 1 where it talks about the words of the wise and their riddles. And I don't think we associate riddles with the Bible very often. We talk about riddles personally and we think they're very fun, and then we go read the Bible and we don't always recognize that maybe there's some riddles hidden in the text for us to go look for and find and dig up and understanding. And once we do understand those, what meaning does it unlock for us in our service to God? So I'm going to start by reading the whole of Proverbs 30, and I'm going to ask that as we do, try to consider it as a whole. Try to look for the terms that come up that are interstitched throughout the proverb and not just coming up once or twice. And how are the things later in the proverb related to things earlier in the proverb and so on. I will have it up here on the screen. And I'll be primarily using New American Standard, depending on how you want to follow along. I have altered a couple words from New American Standard, but only to become more literal. There's sometimes where they put a more common meaning. And it's actually, I think, detracts it by getting further from the text. And so I've inserted the more literal term that they will nod to in some of those places. So Proverbs 30. The words of Agur, the son of Jacob, the oracle. The man declares to Ithiel, and to Ukol. Surely, I am more stupid than any man, and I do not have the understanding of a man. Neither have I learned wisdom, nor do I have knowledge of the Holy One. Who has ascended into heaven and descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped the waters in his garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name or his son's name? Surely you know. Every word of God is tested. He is a shield to those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words or he will reprove you and you will be proved a liar. Two things I have asked of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food that is my portion, that I not be full and deny you and say who is the Lord, or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. Do not slander a slave to his master, or he will curse you and you'll be found guilty. There's a generation who curses his father and does not bless his mother. There's a generation who is pure in his own eyes, yet is not washed from his filthiness. There's a generation, oh, how lofty are his eyes, and his eyelids are raised in arrogance. There's a generation whose teeth are swords and his jaw teeth knives to devour the afflicted from the earth and the needy from among men. The leech has two daughters. Give, give. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. Sheol and the barren womb, earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough. The eye that mocks the father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out and young eagles will eat it. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I've done no wrong. Under three things the earth quakes, and under four it cannot bear up. Under a slave when he becomes king, and a fool when he's satisfied with food. Under an unloved woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. Four things are small on the earth, but they're exceedingly wise. Ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. The Shephanim are not a mighty people, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. And the lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet he's in king's palaces. There's three things which are stately in their march, even four which are stately when they walk. The lion, which is mighty among beasts and does not need to retreat before any. That which is girt in the loins. The male goat also. And the king when his army is with him. If you have been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have plotted evil, hand to mouth. For the pressing of milk produces butter, the pressing of the nose brings forth blood, and the pressing of anger produces strife. So there we have the proverb before us. And I'll just say before I get into some of this text in more detail, I apologize. Some of the breaks I had put in the text there might have been confusing if you were following along. I apologize if that threw you off. But I've been looking at this proverb for quite a while now and continuing to kind of meditate on it and study it. And I will say, I am just blown away by how much I have seen that is in here and so much that we won't cover tonight that is just laying rich in this text. But B, even as I've continued to study up until today, it has not slowed down the types of things that can be derived from this text. In other words, I have a feeling that I've only captured 10%, 25%, maybe 50% of some of the interesting things going on in this text. And so I think the feeling that is right to feel as we encounter this chapter is it's like you came up to an old wise sage and you wanted to have hours and hours of conversation with them. And they said, no, I'm not going to talk to you for hours. I'll give you this five-minute thing. You can read it in 5 minutes. He said, but I want to ask you all these questions. He said, no, this is enough. Just read this. And that's how this chapter functions, that we can go and walk away and study it as words from a wise sage and from God, obviously, just continually and over and over and over and continue to glean wisdom from it. I have up here the opening of the proverb. In that first line, the words of Agur, the son of Jacob, the oracle, the man declares to Ithiel, Ithiel to Ukul. It's an interesting way to open this proverb. Typically, when you see names in the Bible, you see them several times because it's a common name. This is an interesting phrasing of these names because the only one of these that ever comes up anywhere else in the Bible is Ithiel, I want to say. It might have been Ukul, but I believe it's Ithiel. Which comes up once in Nehemiah in a way that seems totally unrelated to anybody who would be a part of this proverb. They're just somebody in a random genealogy. But these names have meanings. So Agur means collector. And you could just as well read this, the words of the collector. Maybe that's not their personal name. Maybe this is some Solomonic kind of figure who has been called the collector. Just like when you look in Ecclesiastes, we have the words of the teacher. In Hebrew, it's not actually the teacher, it's the collector of the people, one who calls forth all the people. And so that may be some term that's more of a type of a figure rather than an exact name. The word Jacah means obedience, and Ithiel and Ukal both have their own name meanings. This little bubble I put up here is how Young's literal translation puts it. I like referencing that on occasion because it's like hyper-literal. And so instead of trying to transliterate names, it will just give you the meaning. And this is how they render it. Words of a gatherer, son of an obedient one, the declaration and affirmation of the man, I've wearied myself for God, I've wearied myself for God, and am consumed. That consumed comes from the name Ukal, which is almost identical to a Hebrew word to eat or to devour or to consume. And if you pay attention as we go through the proverb, you'll see that coming up. And so maybe there's an intent to the usage of that name. The other thing we see here is that this, as Agur is talking, there seems to be, in most of the proverbs that come up, there's kind of a typical pattern of it being a king talking to his sons or to son-like figures. And so as we see Agur here, the son of Jacob, and he's talking to Ithiel and Ukal, we don't know who these are, but these may be sons or some servants or somebody that he's trying to convey information to, but it's likely that we have three or four generations contained within these names. And then he starts and says something that feels a little bit backwards. If you come to somebody who you're expecting to glean eternal wisdom from, and they start and they say, surely I'm more stupid than any man, and I do not have the understanding of a man. I think what is going on here is that the words of Agur are being put to us very similar to the way, as I would picture, if you could take Job, and if he could talk to us after the book of Job has taken place, that this is the way he would talk. As he struggled with God, and at the end, God gives him all these questions about, can you tell me how the Leviathan was made, and can you tell me how this was done, and how this was done? And Job ultimately had to reckon with the fact that even though he had been a very righteous man and may have had a lot of wisdom, that those things were just so far beyond his understanding that all he can do is call out that those are beyond my understanding. And that's what I think Agur is doing here. I think he's being sarcastic when he says, surely I'm more stupid than any man. I don't have the understanding of a man. Neither have I learned wisdom. I think as we'll begin to see as we go through the proverb, Ithiel and Ukal, who he's giving advice to, might be a little bit stuck up. And so I think that's his way of kind of defeating it at the beginning, is saying, I'm not going to tell you that I'm anything great. In fact, I'm way stupider than you guys. But he's going to come back at them with something they can't answer. And he's going to reflect the glory to God rather than to himself. And so he gives these questions. Who has ascended into heaven and descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped the waters in his garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name? Or his son's name, surely you know. And again, I think that surely you know lends itself to kind of the sarcasm that he's kind of badgering the people he's talking to. Come on, surely you can answer all these things, right? Sometimes I think we jump to assume that the ascending to heaven, descending, and then we see his son's name, that this is like a prophecy about Jesus. While we can look backwards and potentially match Jesus to some of these attributes, I don't know that that's the direct point of this. The term ascension we use in modern day English very closely linked to Jesus ascending from the grave. Ascending and descending more commonly in this time frame, I think, would have been like sacrifices went up to God, they ascended, and God, who was in the heavens, would come down to look on a particular land and visit them to see if their sin was worthy of destruction. So I don't know that it's as direct as that. And in fact, the Hebrews, as this was written, their closest reference to a son of God would have been when God gave his name a chapter later in Exodus 4. He calls Israel his firstborn son. So I think while it is possibly can enlighten a little bit in view of Jesus, I don't know that that's directly the point of this. But what we do see here is the mastery of God's creation. And these terms that remind us, I feel like, very much of like Genesis 1, when we see, I think I advanced this, one second. I accidentally clicked that forward, I apologize. When we see things like gathering the wind in his fist, wrapping the waters in his garment, a lot of Psalm poetry will describe the creation story that way. That, you know, the clouds and the stars are like a blanket that he casts upon the sky. And so we see God's handiwork here. Not so much as a puzzle that would confuse you, but as a puzzle that makes us think, who could ever do this? There's no way I could come close to doing this. And then he goes on after saying, what is his name or his son's name? Surely you know. And he says these next four lines. Every word of God is tested. He's a shield to those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words or he will reprove you, and you will be proved a liar. So the word using for tested here, where it says every word of God is tested, I think is actually the same word as you would use for testing a metal. So when you put a metal through the fire, you burn off all the dross, you purify it. That every word of God is like that. It is just absolutely a purified metal. There's no flaw in it at all. And I think that's really cool because from like a metallurgical standpoint, the next statement is he's a shield to those who take refuge in him. So there's kind of that picturesque notion that God's words are so true and pure that just as purified metal is like his words, his own function is then to be a shield that protects you with those words. And then the phrasing in reverse, which is like his advice to Ithiel and to Ukal, do not add to his words or he will reprove you and you will be proved a liar. In other words, if we are going to put our words to the test, the only way they're going to pass the test is if we have simply taken God's words and let those stand. If we add to those, we've added dross to that. Those will be proved through the fire, and guess what you're going to find? You're going to find the flaws in that. Then he goes on to his request that we mentioned earlier. Two things I have asked of you. Do not refuse me before I die. Keep deception and lies far from me, and give me neither poverty nor riches. First, I think it's interesting because that's three things. For a while, I was reading this, so I was like, oh, yeah, there's two things there. And I was like, no, there's a third one. And you might even say that feeding me with food that is my portion is just a reiteration of give me neither poverty or riches. So maybe you say there's two things and then there's a third one that's like it, at which point I would say, yeah, that's exactly what he's doing throughout the whole proverb. And so I think it's interesting that there's three things there. But the point here, I think, is that two things. One is deception and one is contentment. And so the deception kind of leaks back to exactly what he had just talked about the words of God being pure, and anything we add will distort that. And so he's asking to be kept from deception, to be kept from those false words. And again, as context, if you look back at the very first word or words of Proverbs 30, it starts with the words of Agur. And so I think what we're being kind of hinted at here is the words of Agur are really the words of God. That Agur, this older, wiser sage, is content with letting his speech be the words of God and not his own ideas. And then he moves on to those statements more about contentment and not needing too much, not needing too little, and just being okay with that balance. And the result then is he says that I not be full and deny you and say who is the Lord, or that I not be in want and steal and profane the name of my God. And then it looks like he switches topics here. He says, do not slander a slave to his master. He will curse you and you will be found guilty. And he goes on in this statement about generations, which I'll cover in a minute. What's interesting to me is it would appear that God and the inspired author are referencing a whole lot of things in Deuteronomy that I find very interesting. So first of all, this phrase, every word of God is tested. And then it says, do not add to his words. The closest scriptural link to that is Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2. You shall not add to the word which I am commanding you, nor take away from it, that you keep the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you. So that's just kind of an interesting note. But after that, there's a lot of things in here that I think nod to the Ten Commandments. And at first you might say, okay, what's going on here? That doesn't seem like a direct notion. But look here in Deuteronomy 4, verse 10. So, for memory's sake, the first reading of the Ten Commandments is in Exodus 20, but it comes up again in Deuteronomy chapter 5 and is repeated. We're right now in Deuteronomy chapter 4. It says in verse 10 there, remember the day you stood before the Lord your God at Horeb, when the Lord said to me, assemble the people to me, that I may let them hear my words, so that they may learn to fear me all the days they live on the earth, and that they may teach their children. So he declared to you his covenant, which he commanded you to perform, that is, the 10 words. If you're reading in your own Bible, it said commandments. That is not the Hebrew word for commandments. That is the Hebrew word for words. And ancient Israelites referred to the 10 commandments as the 10 words. That was the Hebrew way of responding to it. So he gave you these 10 words and wrote them on two tablets of stone. And so as we look at some of these phrases, it's interesting how right in the same section we'll start seeing some of those commandments come up. So for instance, it says, or that I not be in want and steal. So there we have the commandment not to steal. And the very next statement, and profane the name of my God, or take God's name in vain. Then there's other things that we could look at, and you say, well, what about a couple other commandments? Let's see if I have it here. So you shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above or on the earth beneath or in the water under the earth. This is coming straight out of the Ten Commandments in Deuteronomy 5 again. You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity on the fathers of the children and on the third and fourth generation of those who hate me. So you look here, the command about not making an idol. If you look at the context, we see some extra commentary here that says visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children on the third and fourth generation. Well, how is the inspired writer included this? Well, look here. There is a generation who curses his father and does not bless his mother. There is a generation who is pure in his own eyes. There is a generation. So he gave us three or four generations as a way of echoing back to that command, while also then including another command about honoring your father and mother. You could also look at what about not coveting, or what about the Sabbath? And as soon as I flip away from this one, we'll see that there's three things that are never satisfied, four things that never say enough. They're never content. They never rest. And so I think what's happening here is that the inspired author, Agur, is trying to get us to think more deeply about the Ten Commandments. If you look at the commandments, don't steal, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. And he's pulling us back to stop and slow down and go, how much of my own inability to follow God can come from me wanting more than I need? There's not a commandment in the Ten Commandments about making sure you eat healthy portions or making sure that you don't make too much money. But then we look in his request about don't give me any more than I need or any less than I need. And then we can look at these Ten Commandments and we can start to see that the ways that our own motivations can be driving us to turn to those things. It's also interesting here when he mentions the generations. He starts talking about a generation who is pure in his own eyes, yet is not washed from his filthiness. So his eyes are pure. But then it says, his lofty, oh, how lofty are his eyes. His eyelids are raised, and it's not included in the text, but the essence of the saying is in arrogance. So you have this generation who is not respecting father and mother, but is starting to become lofty and casting their eyes above. They're looking down on everybody else because they think they're so high as one of their problems. And then the other problem is that they're consuming. There's generations whose teeth are swords and jaw teeth knives to devour the afflicted from the earth. So it's like this combined statement of devouring mixed with this kind of murderous form of talking to the needy from among men. Then I've left the top piece up there so we can still see it. But the following lines, the leech has two daughters, give, give. There are three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough. Sheol and the barren womb. Earth that is never satisfied with water, and fire that never says enough. The eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother, the ravens of the valley will pick it out, and the young eagles will eat it. There's a sort of interstitched commentary, I think, that we're being given here. It looks like we change topics from there being a generation cursing their father and mother, and then we talk about never being satisfied and not having contentment. But then you see this phrase down at the bottom, the eye that mocks a father and scorns a mother. So we're back up to those statements about the generations, oh, how lofty are their eyes. They're up and they're looking down on their parents thinking they've got everything figured out. Well, what is the curse that will come upon them if they curse their parents? Well, a raven will fly up and will come down and pick out your eyes. And an eagle will fly up and will look down and will pluck out your eyes. And the irony here is that second, there is a generation who is pure in his own eyes, yet is not washed from his filthiness. To an ancient Israelite, think unclean. He thinks his eyes are pure. He thinks that they're perfect, but his eyes are really unclean, and he's not catching that. A raven is an unclean bird under the old law. So this generation who thinks that they're so pure and clean, well, an unclean animal is going to come and not just make them unclean, but is going to pick out their eyeballs. That's how strong the language is there. But we can kind of see that back and forth that's going on in the text. And then we also see with this three statement and four statement, it starts off with the leech has two daughters, give, give. I think that just gives us an interesting nod towards that notion of consumption, just give, 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 give. It's a one-track mind. But there's also, if you pay close attention, there's a couple times that we might see an example of two daughters or two women and how that'll play out in further texts. And then in the actual smaller riddle itself, three things that will not be satisfied, four that will not say enough, we see Sheol and the barren womb. And while one is related to death and one is related to life, you can see those very clearly as instances of that they both say, give, give. So I think that statement of two is also connected to the statement of three and four. Down towards the bottom here, there are three things which are too wonderful for me, four which I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on the rock, the way of a ship in the middle of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. Most of the commentary on this one, I don't know that it does justice to what's being said. I think when we read this in our English 2019 minds, and we see the way of an eagle in the sky, we go, oh, we understand that now. We have physics, we have planes. We can understand what's going on inside with an eagle and how they can fly and how that works. And the ancient writer, maybe he didn't understand that, so he said, oh, wow, that's too wonderful for me. I'll never understand how they fly. And so it goes on like that with the things that he doesn't understand. I don't think that's what's going on here at all. Just like Agur started out by saying, I'm more brutish than any man. I don't have the understanding of a man. I don't know anything. I don't think his intent to here is to say, I scientifically do not understand this, so I'm just handing this over to you to think about. I think there's something deeper going on. The other thing that's interesting is if you actually consider, he's not saying it's an eagle I don't understand. He said the way of an eagle. So what about an eagle seeing a fish in the sea from way, way high up and being able to spot it and track it and move? If you plotted that movement, is that just a linear, like, I see this thing and I point and click and I get it? Or is that a whole tracking and an amazing wandering path to come down and get to its target? You look at the next one, a serpent on a rock. Okay, a serpent at a high level, you can kind of see it move in a straightforward direction. But if you actually track it moment by moment and try to like plot out where it moves, it's a wandering path. The way of the serpent is a very kind of interesting conundrum. And the same thing with the ship in the sea. You can look at a ship and say, yeah, we're going to go from point A to point B. But if you watch it moment by moment, sometimes the water's going this way and you're going that way. And then the water's going this way and you're going that way. It's not linear. And the way of a man with a woman or the way of a groom with his bride, that is not linear. Yes, from point A to point B, you can go from meeting to dating to marriage to life together. But a man trying to figure out a woman, that is not linear. That is not simple. It's a pursuit, and it's interesting, and it gets from point A to point B, but it's wandering. It's something that really takes a deeper understanding. You can't just put that into one little answer and say, I have it all figured out. It's something to think about and something to understand. What's also interesting about these terms is they follow a typical creation-esque form in the way that ancient Israel would often form their understanding of, not geography, but of the heavens and the earth. So if you look at the order of creation, it goes from the sky, so birds and fish in the sea, then to the land animals, and then to human. And then if you go back and look at that statement earlier about God, how he stretches the blanket in the sky, and how he established the ends of the earth, it follows that same tiered structure of sky, water, land. And so it's a nod here that we need to be going back and considering the great works of God. And not just taking these for granted, but really saying, okay, yes, technically I get how an eagle could fly, but do I really get the way of an eagle? Do I really get it, or is that something that God has made and is amazing? And I just need to sit back and observe that that is amazing. And then we see after this statement, this is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and says, I have done no wrong. At which point we feel like it's totally non sequitur because we were just talking about eagles in the sky. But notice, there's a lot going on here. One, you can look at the very last statement, the way of a man with a maid. which seems very pure, very one man, one woman, a pursuit of a real relationship, next to the adulterous woman in that picture of discontentment and constant consumption and never being full and satisfied. You can also look at that and go back to the generation statements. What did they end with? There's a generation, this one's the sort of the more the male perspective, whose teeth are swords and jaw teeth knives to devour the afflicted from the earth. So you have the man who's devouring the afflicted and the poor and the needy, and you have the adulterous woman who's devouring man after man after man after man. And so all the interconnections here, I think, are really interesting. Then we get to the next set of three and four. Under three things, the earth quakes, and under four, it cannot bear up. Under a slave when he becomes king, a fool when he's satisfied with food, an unloving woman when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. Couple things on this where these seem like they're coming with a slant. So I don't think that this is teaching that a slave should never ever be able to become a king. I think this is using a more common or a more derogatory is not the right idea, but a lesser view of a slave. In other words, if you have a slave who's really just deserves to be a slave, understand I don't mean what I'm saying there. But if you have a slave who's really just acting like a slave and they become queen, king, watch out. Have they been used to that responsibility? And to take this back a notch, when we look at the way of an eagle, the way of a ship in the sea, whatever, if you just take a slave and make them king right away, can you expect good results? Absolutely not. If you take a slave and say, one day you will become king, so we're going to go do this lesson over here and this lesson over here, and we're going to work at this year after year after year after year, absolutely a slave could become king. But for a slave to just be promoted and become king, the earth quakes. A fool when he's satisfied with food. One, I think this is a little bit of a mockery of like, the fool is never satisfied, they're never full, they just keep eating. But I think there's also a sense here with, just as food has been used non-literally elsewhere, that there's a sense of a fool actually prospering, like a fool actually having enough to eat and having enough money to live off. That's also a bit of a shocker. That's not supposed to happen. Then we see an unloved woman when she gets a husband. This is another one where the term unloved woman, I don't know that this is just black and white saying a woman who was previously not loved becoming a woman who gets a husband. Because I think everybody who was not married, who becomes married, kind of goes through that process. I think the term unloved there is more closely associated to hated and maybe bitter. So it's almost like under a bitter woman when she gets a husband. Maybe gives us a bit more of the essence there. And then a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. And you can kind of see this echo of consumption again, that there's a mistress who finally gets a husband, but then there's a maidservant who finally supplants her mistress. And maybe that's the adulterous woman who will just move on to another man and another man and another man. And so you can see the sense of vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Four things are small on the earth, but they're exceedingly wise. The ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. The Shephanim are not a mighty people, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet they all go out in ranks. And the lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet it is in king's palaces. I think it's interesting, there's kind of a back and forth echo here. So ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food and they also go out in ranks. And that kind of matches the locusts. The locusts have no king, but they go out in ranks. And then the Shephanim, which is some weird form of a badger, like a very insignificant animal, they are known because they have a mighty house, that they make their house in the rocks. That's how they're smart. And that matches the lizard, I think, which even though it's so small, you can grasp with the hands, it can get into a king's palace. And I think it's worthy of note as he's beginning to kind of maybe cast down Ithiel and Ukel as unwise young men or as these slaves who are thinking too highly of themselves, that he's like, here's some small things. Can you even do what these small things can? And so here you get this idea that you can grasp a lizard with your hands, but it can get into a king's palace. So before we talked about a slave and how that's unfitting for a slave to just become king. And now he's like, but let me tell you, a lizard can become king. How does a lizard get into a king's palace even though it's weak? It's silent. It just walks right in. Nobody notices because it's not running its mouth. There are three things which are stately in their march, even four which are stately when they walk. The lion, which is mighty among beasts, or king among beasts, and does not retreat before any. that which girts the loins, the male goat also, and a king when his army is with him. So here we see another set of two and two, and the lion, who is like a king among beasts, kind of matches that which is girt in the loins, and the male goat, and that which is girt in the loins kind of matches with a king when his army is with him. So first of all, that which is girt in the loins is a very weird sentence. A lot of translators put that as the rooster. It's not the word for rooster, but people suspect, because we're in lists of animals, that this must be an animal. So what's an animal that phrasing could be used for? But ultimately, if you think of similarly people girding their loins to run or go into battle, it's some kind of combination of thinking about animals, and that is kind of what we're left with in the text. But you can kind of see there's out of those four things that are stately in their march, there's two that just have the strength. There's the lion and the he-goat. They just have innate strength. And the two that don't have innate strength, they're prepared. One is girt in the loins, and the other is not just a king, but a king when his army is with him. That's when he can walk stately, because he's prepared for it. And then it moves to the conclusion. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, and that's why I think, again, he's talking to Ithiel and Ukul as if they are kind of that slave who's not ready to become king. They're trying to boost themselves up. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have plotted evil, hand to mouth. Just cover it up. For the pressing of milk produces butter, the pressing of the nose brings forth blood, and the pressing of anger produces strife. First of all, there's an interesting wordplay here. The word for nose and anger in Hebrew are almost identical, and so it's kind of just a cool little riddle that they put there together. But what's interesting is, without being told so, this is another grouping of three or maybe four. So you have the word pressing come up all three times. It doesn't always translate that way, but it is the same word. So you can press milk and make butter. You can make some food. You can press a nose and make blood. You can press anger and make strife. But what should you press? You should take your hand and press it on your mouth. And that's, I think, the major point that Agur is trying to get across. If you put your hand on your mouth, A, you stop talking. And B, you stop filling yourself so full and devouring and wiping your mouth. You just are content with what you have. It's interesting, though, I think, what Agur has done with this whole proverb in mind. I've got at the bottom the very last few lines of the proverb, and up at the top, the very first. One commonality that comes up is the actual pressing. So at the end, we see this term pressing, that the fool is essentially doing in all these bad ways. The word oracle up at the top is the word for burden. And so you see this comparison and contrasting, that Agur is burdened with an oracle to just simply declare the words of God. Whereas the fool is burdened with producing strife, producing blood, things like that. And there's also a whole argument here about what is going on with your hands then. That if you've got this burden, or if you've got this pressing, here's what you should do with your hands, that you're going to put it on your mouth. And it comes up in really interesting ways. So in the beginning, you start with Agur, who's got the burden. That's what he's doing with his hands. And then when we're presented with that image of God, we see his handiwork. He can gather things in a cloak. He can spread out a blanket. So we see God's handiwork. Then we see that statement that the lizard, even though you can grasp it with your hands, can make it in king's palaces. And so, like, the message he's sending is, don't be so cocky. You think you've got it all figured out. But really, the best thing you can do with your hands, if you're exalting yourself, is to just cause yourself to be quiet. That's really the most valuable thing you can do with your hands. But I also think then, in that notion of putting your hands on your mouth and covering up your speech, there's even a deeper message there. Notice again that this started by saying the words of Agur. Not the words of God, the words of Agur. But then what is the burden he puts on himself? That he took God's words, not just God's individual words, like here's a word, but he even took God's 10 words, God's commandments. And he's thought about them so deeply that as he speaks them and gives them back and continues to speak, he's really just speaking God's words. And that's the burden of I think, the old wise sage, is to have collected through a whole lifetime all of these sayings of God and to have really thought about them. So that as a younger generation comes, that you can simply put out these words and those are enough to chew on for a lifetime and leave you content. And I think that's the message for us, is to then take this proverb and, as much as I probably feel like I'm done because I've studied for this and now I preach on it. Now I'm done. I don't need to go read it. The real message for all of us is to go read this over and over and over again and to take the words of God and to collect them and put them inside ourselves and to be content with what he's given us and then to go forth. So that's what I've got for the lesson this evening. I hope that it was an interesting study in some of the riddles of God. If you do need to come forward, either to make your life right in any way, I don't know that we have any buddy who needs to, but if you need to, absolutely come forward. And after that, we'll have a song in the Lord's Supper.